But seriously, it really is a huge honour to be here today and to be invited to talk about something I absolutely love, Broadway's lesser-known gems. To a room full of like-minded people is an absolute pleasure too, so thank you very much for having me. Right, first of all, a little bit about myself. I've loved music ever since I can remember. My earliest memories are of my mum singing me to sleep every night, mainly because I was such a pest and didn't sleep at all. But my mum always sang to me. And another vivid memory is of our polished parquet flooring in our sitting room, otherwise known as my stage, where I could often be found reenacting various Broadway hits, and a big favourite was the Sound of Music. A key prop was one of my mum's aprons, which I would blithely wear on my head as I quite naturally took the lead role as Maria, with the surrounding furniture as my mountains. There I was, driving my brother's mad, dancing and singing at the top of my voice. I loved it. And as you've no doubt already gathered, my mum was the big influence. She would sing the songs from Oklahoma and South Pacific in the car on the way to school every day, and those songs lit the touch paper to what has become a lifelong love of classic Broadway shows. And after a lifetime of loving the songs and being fascinated by the people who wrote them, I've been lucky enough in the last few years to start writing about them for radio and television too. And it seems to unleash the passion, almost as strong as the one I've always had for singing. Like any singer, I've always collected piles of lovely local albums over the years. And when I was younger, I used to just skip to the really well-known ones. But as time went on, I'd start to linger on the lesser-known ones. And when I started to piece together where they came from, now that was like opening up a veritable treasure trove of stories. So I'd like you to invite you to just sit back, relax, and let's start off by turning the clock right back to the Roaring Twenties. In New York in 1923, a rather striking 19-year-old girl singer stepped up for her big moment in a new George White show on Broadway called Running Wild. The show was fast-paced, up to the minute, and full of glamour, and the young singer delivered her new song, surrounded by a bevy of beauties, dancing crazy new routine they called the Charleston. The Charleston swept through the nation and became the hottest dance craze of the Roaring Twenties. The young singer went on to enjoy a career that spanned more than 60 years, famous for her unique style, musicianship, and crystal clear diction. And she was adored by all and sundry for bringing sophistication to the art of popular song. The young singer's name was Elizabeth Welch, and just over 60 years later, I was lucky enough to be sitting in the audience at the Donmar Warehouse in London, watching her perform a song from 1931 that simply stole my heart away. It was 1985, and actor, singer, and producer David Kerner had put together a small-scale review of the Donmar Warehouse, in which he starred with Liz Robertson, Elaine Delmar, and the by-now legendary Elizabeth Welch. The review was called Kern Goes to Hollywood, and David Kernan had put it together to celebrate the centenary of Jerome Kern's birth. Born in New York in 1885, Jerome Kern had gone on to become one of Broadway's biggest songwriters, collaborating with Otto Harbach, Oscar Hammerstein, Ira Gershwin, Dorothy Fields, and P.G. Woodhouse. And then, when he went to Hollywood in 1935, he won the Academy Award for Best Song twice over for The Way You Look Tonight and The Last Time I Saw Paris. When Kern Goes to Hollywood opened at the Donmar on the 28th of May 1985, the critics went wild. In the Daily Mail, Jack Tinker described it as a joyous musical entertainment, and it won Elizabeth Welch a nomination for Laurence Olivier Award. I was 24 years old when I watched her walk forward in this song. It's from the 1931 musical Kern wrote with lyricist Otto Harbach. And it's from the show called The Cat and the Fiddle. The song was She Didn't Say Yes, and how lucky I was to see her. Now that was the song we were just trying to make work just a moment ago. So let's hope we get more. Oh, I can't sing it. Oh, I love that song. So it's pure indulgence, that. I always used to think, how can man, I know it sounds terribly sexist, so I beg your pardon, how can man write those beautiful lyrics about how hard it is to be in love with somebody? You know, you shouldn't be in love with. And then, of course, I read it properly in the top right-hand corner of the page and saw that it was a lovely lady that wrote those lyrics. Oh, yes, Dorothy Fields, I've loved her from her. Now, of all the colourful characters that I've been looking at writing about for today, but there was one that, obviously, when you look back into the past on Broadway, you can't miss him. And his name was Wade, the Greatest Showman, they called him, and his name was Mr. Florence Ziegfeld. He was born in Chicago in 1887. He had a taste for publicity from a very young age, and often boasted in later life that he had outshot Annie Oakley in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at the tender age of 16. This was made even more remarkable by the fact that it was 2 years before she even joined the show. But it seems that the great Ziegfeld was never one for letting the truth get in the way of a jolly good story. When he was only 20 in 1907, he introduced his Ziegfeld Follies to Broadway, based on the same format as the glamorous Folies Bergères in Paris. Extravagant sets and elaborate costumes with beautiful girls parading the stage in the most stunning production numbers. Choreographed to the music of the best composers of the day. Then in 1913, at his sixth annual production of the Follies, Florence Ziegfeld moved his show to the extravagant Art Nouveau style New Amsterdam Theatre on West 42nd Street. And it's at this theatre where an enduring rumour lingers of one of Ziegfeld's girls, whose beautiful, ghostly presence lingers even to this day. I first heard the story when I was on a research trip to New York last year, and it's fascinated me ever since. In 1920, Olive Thomas, one of Ziegfeld's so-called favourite girls, died tragically in suspicious circumstances from accidental poisoning, wait for it, whilst on second honeymoon, with her in Paris with her husband Jack Pickford, and he's Mary Pickford's brother. Olive Thomas was a real, but by all accounts, wild beauty, and she hit big time in silent films after she made it on the Follies. But it was at the New Amsterdam where she had her big break as a Ziegfeld girl, and it seems this is where she was most at home, because down through the years since her untimely and rather gruesome death, there have been countless reports of run-ins with the once flirtatious Miss Thomas backstage at the New Amsterdam. She apparently only ever appears to the opposite sex, night watchmen, builders, stagehands. Sometimes she speaks, sometimes she beckons, just before disappearing through a wall or a floor. And she's always seen in one of her lovely beaded dresses. And with sightings of her, even in the most recent past, the management of the New Amsterdam decided they might be able to appease their ghostly resident by hanging framed photos of her just inside the entrances to the theatre. So her presence is never forgotten, and the night watchmen always make a point of bidding her good evening as they come and go. And when I was reading about this, I thought, that's quite a fitting epitaph for the great showman who couldn't resist a good bit of publicity here and there. Ziegfeld. Now, when he died in 1932, his obituary in the New York Times reported, "He had been known to take as many as 100 trunks with him when he travelled. He had 2 gold telegrams on his desk, and he enriched the telegraph companies considerable by his fondness for sending 500-word telegrams." And after his death, Ziegfeld's second wife, Billie Burke, kept the Follies running. She's best known to most of us as the Good Witch in The Wizard of Oz. And in partnership with the rather infamous Schubert brothers, Billie Burke's Ziegfeld Follies, 1936, opened at the Winter Garden Theatre, starring, amongst others, Fanny Brice and Josephine Baker. One of the songs from that show epitomises the glorious era of the Ziegfeld Follies that was soon to fade into legend. With music by Vernon Duke and Ira Gershwin, it was staged by the great George Balanchine, and it's sung here today, hopefully a bit louder because this track is louder, by Ruthie Henschel, an and it's called Words Without Music. So if it's really loud, watch out. Fingers crossed.
And then a man comes on and sings a song. There's no good traditional chorus number.
Irving Berlin had it there 3 years before, and later on in Louisiana Purchase there's even a Dream Ballet sequence, and I think that, I always thought, no, it was Oklahoma was the first, but actually Irving Berlin, they were all working towards the same goal, all together. It was just Oklahoma, I suppose, that just hit the spot perfectly. And so that's why I thought, what a wonderful thing, Irving Berlin had that 3 years before. And the critics agreed, it was one of Irving Berlin's best stage scores. It had choreography by George Balanchine again, he was just the leading man at that time. But it just didn't hit the spot. I mean, you hear about Louisiana Purchase, but I could never really recall any of the songs from it. Irving Berlin, I think it has to be said whenever you mention his name. Whenever I'm talking to students about him, I was going, how old did Irving Berlin live to be? It was a bit like George Abbott, he lived to be about 900. But Irving Berlin lived to be 101 years old. And he's one, just because we just know him, as one of the most prolific songwriters on Broadway of all time. And he wrote more than 900 songs, 19 musicals, and I think 18 scores for films. And when Jerome Callum was asked to describe Irving Berlin's place in American music, his response went down in history. Does anybody know what it was? Yeah, Irving Berlin has no place in American music. He is American music. And you think, what a wonderful thing to say. And so very generous of Jerome Kern as well. So here is a song from that lesser known show, Louisiana Purchase. Lovely and jolly now. It's called Outside of That, I Love You. Sung here by Dinah Shore. And a man, when you hear him, always sounds like Bing Crosby. And his name's Dick Todd, but he was always being teased for sounding like Bing Crosby. But you listen to him here, you think, is that Bing Crosby in the background? But here we go. Outside of That, I Love You.
Would be happy to lead you toward that score. Yeah. So there's some just wonderful songs and numbers from that. So if you'd like to know a little bit more about it, then I can lead you in that direction.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Right. Talking of that era, 1939, and it's just lovely that you saw that, so I'd love to talk to you about that later as well, on death. Oklahoma, 1943, hailed as the actual phenomenon that there was one person, Oscar Hammerstein, really wanted for his new musical, that fate had sent in quite another direction. She was an up-and-coming singer, actress, dancer, and her name was Mary Martin. And she made her name for herself in singing My Heart Belongs to Daddy in Cole Porter's Leave It to Me in 1938. In 1943, however, she wasn't signed for Oklahoma, but for a show that was to close just after a few short weeks called Dancing in the Streets. She must have been kicking herself. But after what must surely have been a disappointing start to the year for her, fate delivered Miss Martin another show, a rather charming Kurt Weill Ogden Nash show, called One Touch of Venus, about a statue who comes to life. Mary Martin was never overtly confident about her singing voice. A few years later, when Rodgers and Hammerstein offered her the role of Nellie Forbush in South Pacific, she asked them why on earth, because she was going to be singing with Asia Pinder, well-known operatic bass, and she asked them why on earth they want to cast two basses in the lead role. But just like Elizabeth Welsh, she knew how to interpret her songs. When you watch her, she was bright, mischievous, full of verve, and had the ability to bring any stage to life. One Touch of Venus was a hit as well. And John Chapman, in the Sunday New York Daily News, wrote, "She hit a stride which I think will carry her as far as she wants to go in the theatre." And let's face it, she went right all the way. Here she is singing from One Touch of Venus, "I am a stranger here myself." I absolutely love this song. Does anybody know it? Oh, it's just gorgeous.
Tell me, is love still a popular suggestion, or merely an obsolete art? Forgive me for asking this simple question. I'm unfamiliar with his heart. I'm a stranger here myself. Why is it wrong to murmur I adore him when it's shamefully obvious I do? Does love embarrass him, or does it bore him? I'm only waiting for my cue. I'm a stranger here myself. I dream of a day, of a gay, warm day with my face between his hands. Have I missed the path? Have I gone astray? I ask, and no one understands. Love me or leave me, that seems to be the question. I don't know the tactics to use, but if he should offer a personal suggestion, how could I possibly refuse when I'm a stranger here myself?
When I'm a friend.
when she was listening through to the music. I think Roger's nurse started playing her the music to try and get her interested in playing Nellie Forbush for South Pacific. And she got so excited sitting on the piano stool singing through the song, so she actually fell off the piano stool. Just imagine it. Now, when it opened on Broadway in 1944, On the Town was described by Lewis Nichols of the New York Times as the freshest and most engaging musical show to come this way since the golden day of Oklahoma. More to the point for us today, On the Town marked the Broadway debut of four major talents: Leonard Bernstein, Betty Comden, Adolph Green, and Jerome Robbins. And to add to all this talent, they had the veritable godfather of the theatre directing all their efforts, Mr. George Abbott. He was always known as Mr. On the Town was lively and fun and had all the ingredients of an absolute smash. It was topical, about three sailors on shore leave in New York for 24 hours. It had wonderful, vibrant songs like New York, New York, it's a hell of a town. And critics hailed it a hit, and it ran for 463 performances. And then in 1949, On the Town got the Hollywood treatment. Here was a prime example of a brilliantly composed musical which had won acclaim on Broadway, running into trouble with the movie moguls. It all started when Arthur Freed of MGM decided he just didn't like Leonard Bernstein songs enough and proceeded to cut all but three of them. He then hired a new composer, Roger Edens, who wrote the music all over again, but with lyrics by Comden and Green. So in 2005, having watched the film and loved it all through my childhood, imagine my surprise when I went along to see the English National Opera's production of the show. It was directed by Jude Kelly and choreographed by Stephen Mear. And even though it was only on for a limited run, All the Town went on to break all box office records at the Colosseum, and it became the most successful production in E&O's history. As for me, I went right back and saw it all over again as soon as I possibly could, a couple of weeks later with my mum in tow, as I couldn't believe my eyes and ears. It was uplifting and wonderful. And now with an equally glorious revival of the original show running on Broadway today, it seems that at last, On the Town, the right version is here to stay, quite right. Now, here comes a little treat. Over the past year, I've had the pleasure of teaching a young student who's over here in Oxford, visiting from Canada with her parents. Her name is Shannon Poole. She's just turned 16, and I realised after a very short space of time that she was every bit as excited by the classic Broadway shows as I've always been. It was during a lesson a few months ago when we were both flicking through a volume of songs trying to decide what to do next, when Shannon suddenly stopped and said, "Oh, I love this one." Well, how could I resist? It was only one of the songs that had been unceremoniously thrown out of On the Town for the film in 1949. So instead of a track from my iTunes library, please welcome to the stage Miss Shannon Poole singing "I Can Cook Too" from On the Town with her accompanist, Miss Jane Powell. Shannon would like to start from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. Have you got those words in your head now? You're surrounded by people that all know exactly how you feel, so don't be nervous. Go for it.
In the 1920s. And now in the mid-1940s, Hammerstein
Hammerstein was at the top of his game, and Kern was a respected writer who had perhaps spent too long out in Hollywood waiting for the right show to lure him back east. In late 1945, that moment seemed to have arrived. Following their phenomenal success with Oklahoma, Rodgers and Hammerstein rather shrewdly set themselves up as producers, and they were in talks with Dorothy and Herbert Fields about putting together a new show about the life and times of Annie Oakley called Annie Get Your Gun. Fields had suggested her friend Ethel Merman for the lead, and what better vehicle for Kern to mark his return to his beloved Broadway. And to top it off, there was a revival of Showboat set to open in January 1946 as well, and it was going to open at the Ziegfeld, the very same theatre where they'd opened with Showboat in 1927. So at the age of 60, Jerome Kern was on his way back, and it was going to be great. To mark his return, he penned a new number for Showboat, which he excitedly hummed over the phone to Hammerstein one day from California. And Hammerstein, in turn, wrote the lyrics all the way back in New York, and he was ready for his friend's arrival. But tragedy struck just a few days after Kern arrived in New York. He was out on an errand on Park Avenue and suffered a massive stroke and collapsed on the sidewalk, and he never regained consciousness. He died just a week later on Sunday, the 11th of November 1945, with his wife Eva, his daughter Betty, and his fondest friend Oscar Hammerstein sitting at his bedside. And just as he would have wanted, the show did go on. The revival of Showboat went ahead as planned and was a great success. As was, of course, Annie Get Your Gun, with its new recruit, Mr. Irving Berliner Pell. And as for the brand new song that Kern had hummed over the phone to Hammerstein from California that day, that went right into the show and it's stayed there ever since. It's sung here by Miss Kristen Chenoweth and has the perfect title, Nobody Else But Me.
I'm trying.
I don't want to run over, and I'm sure everybody must be really hungry. So I thought, what I'll do is I'll tell you, I'm going to cut two songs, but I would love to tell you what they are. There's one of them, the next one that I was going to talk about, is from The Most Happy Fellow, Frank Lesser. And it's a wonderful show, and the song that I was going to talk to you about, which is so lovely, was sung by his future wife, his future second wife, Jo Sullivan, and it's called Warm All Over. It's just a really lovely song. It's a great song for a soprano to do as well. And the other one, talking of gorgeous sopranos, Audra McDonald sang this in Ragtime. And that was the other one I was going to talk about. And there is a beautiful song, and I bet some people need to know as well, Your Daddy's Son from Ragtime. And I thought, rather than holding everybody up for lunch today, I thought, right, I'll tell you what those songs are, because, wow, they're lovely. But to finish, I couldn't not finish with this, because it means so much to me. I'm afraid you've just got to listen for another 2 minutes. It wouldn't be right to talk about Broadway without mentioning Stephen Sondheim, who turned 85 in March this year. And there have been all these wonderful shows on to celebrate his 85th birthday. I recently saw Assassins, I went to Sweeney Todd at the Coliseum, Gypsy, at the Savoy Theatre, and Harrington's Pie Mash Shop with the Tooting Arts Club. Fantastic. Did anybody see it in here? It was absolutely fantastic. But I just wanted to finish with something about Sondheim today, and I'm sure you all probably also know the story that he often repeats, that when he was a young lad, he lived down the road from the Hammerstein family. He became friends with their son, Jamie. And then he became really good friends as well with Oscar, who became an absolute father figure to him. And he once said that if Oscar had been a geologist, he'd probably have become a geologist. And whenever you read about interviews with him, or you see him on filmed interviews, he always talks about the day that when he was 15, he took a musical score to Oscar for him to have a look at, and was quite absolutely convinced that he was going to go, let's put the show on, you're a genius. And he just looks the score over, and he's like, I want you to look at this, cast your professional eye over this, and tell me the truth, at the age of 15. And he looks at it, and he very kindly and very tenderly just said, it's terrible. But crucially, he then said it's not untalented, and then proceeded that afternoon to teach him everything he knew about writing a show. And sometimes, always, whenever he's talking about it, even the more classical stuff that he's studied, he always takes it back to that afternoon when he was 15, and Oscar sat with him and said, right, this is how you do it. When he finished his celebrated two-volume collection of lyrics and comments in 2011, he wound it all up by musing on famous last words, and I thought, what a good idea for today. One of his favourites is Oscar Wilde's, either that wallpaper goes or I do. As far as his own last words are concerned, he's so far come up with, there's so much stuff to sing. And that pretty much sums up what I felt when I was going through all my songs and thinking, well, what are we going to talk about today? Because I get so excited, my friends will tell me, I get very carried away. And I knew I wanted to finish with a Stephen Sondheim number, but I couldn't choose at all. Until only this week, this cheeky little number, Hope Interview. And I thought, this is perfect. It's perfect for an anniversary. And it's most certainly a lesser-known gem, because it was written by Stephen Sondheim, the man who was taught by Oscar Hammerstein, as a 39th birthday present for the man who married Richard Rogers' daughter. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you a youthful Mr. Stephen Sondheim singing, You're Only As Old As You Look. Here he is.
September 15th, 1955, for Julian Beatty Jr. on his 39th birthday.
You look flashy, you look sporty, you look almost as dashing as Maury. When you're only as old as you look, and you look 40. You look awesome, you look nifty, but when they ask you your age, you look shifty. You're only as old as you look. not the sign of sorrow or disgrace. It's age. Happy birthday, Jerry Baby. May your problems be less and less weighty. When you're only as old as you look, and you look 85, you're practically alive. All of your in-laws you've across all the commands that they make are unlawful. When you're only as old as you look, and you look awful. You feel just like a baby. You've got decades ahead of you, maybe. When you're only as old as you feel, what's your ulcer like? Jamie, you've a rich, full store of memories in that brain. Won't you tell us your adventures in the war with Spain? You look punchy, you look drowsy. The Greeks had a word for it, lousy. Well, you're only as old as you look, but you can't be as old as all that. Happy birthday. Regret it, cause we'll all go right home and forget it.